Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Simon Black. Simon is here to talk to us today about a subject he's been researching all summer, the London riots. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Jeff.
Okay. I understand you've got some unique history and comparisons to tell us, and even relation to the Canadian situation.
Yeah, well, this is not the first time we've seen this kind of urban unrest and riots and looting in a neighborhood, which is mainly populated by poor racialized youth in cities, whether it's London or in Montreal North, when we saw the riots in Montreal following the shooting death of Freddie Villanueva back in 2008, or in Paris. We saw the riots in 2005 and 2009 as well.
And this started with a shooting too, didn't it?
It did. It was a 20-something man by the name of Mark Dugan was shot dead in police custody. And reports found that he was not armed.
Oh.
And he was a resident of Tottenham, which is one of the poorest areas of London.
Okay.
And it's a place of long-standing tensions between the police and the community. The London police are notorious for racially profiling black and brown youth, South Asian youth. And,
really?
Yes, and there have been protests about this kind of racial profiling and kind of community feedback to police in the past. And this kind of police behavior is nothing new, and it would be familiar to anybody living in these neighborhoods.
Indeed, it would be familiar to anybody living in Northwest Toronto.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And some of the neighborhoods that we have in Toronto as well. And the community organized a vigil after finding out about Mark Dugan's shooting. And the police were very slow to release any information out to the family, which was very frustrating. So this is one of the reasons the vigil was organized outside the local police station in Tottenham.
All right.
And policed that vigil very aggressively from all accounts. And this led to, a bit of a standoff between the vigil and the police, which eventually kind of broke out into rioting on Tottenham's High Street, the main street of the neighborhood.
Really?
Now, much to the surprise of people watching us in the media, and it apparently caught the government off guard too, is that the rioting and eventually the looting spread to other parts of London that weren't connected to Tottenham, but definitely had similar kind of socioeconomic profiles to the Tottenham neighborhood, and then spread beyond London to Manchester, areas of Birmingham, England's or the UK's second largest city, and then to Liverpool as well.
I see.
The police announced
these are all cities with large racial minorities in them.
Yeah, poor, and poverty in the UK, like it is in Canada, is racialized. That is, people of color are disproportionately likely to be in the ranks of the poor.
Okay.
Now, the police said that they were going to investigate this, and the police body that is assigned with investigating this, I guess it's the British equivalent of our Special Investigations Unit here, the SIU.
Right.
They've investigated 333 cases since 1998, of people dying in police custody, and there has not been one single conviction.
Really?
So the amount of faith that people in these neighborhoods would have in a body such as that is...
limited.
Probably not great. Yeah, it is limited. Now, the media is focused almost solely on the looting. But really, if you looked at all these cases, whether it was the initial case in Tottenham or the neighborhoods it spread to in London and Manchester, Birmingham, there was pitched street battles between police and youth. And this was something that was kind of overlooked. It was a direct confrontation between police and youth.
All right.
This is not to romanticize it either. It was, it was terrible. It led to the destruction of heritage buildings. The neighborhoods in which the rioters actually lived themselves were destroyed.
Yeah.
You had the kind of intimidation of everyday people, shopkeepers, people walking on the streets. It's gonna impact jobs. So it's not to romanticize this sort of thing. I think some commentators are calling this as kind of an insurrection against the government. But
all right.
I think it should be understood. I think that's important.
Wow. Yeah, we all saw the pictures in the paper of the devastation that was wrought. And I think that was the thing that lost the rioters' broad Western public sympathy. But their situation shouldn't be overlooked either.
Well, that's the thing in the context. And I think the attention to context is really important. And right, there's been kind of like right and left perspectives and responses. To what happened, and from the right, you could almost have written the right script before this even happened. David Cameron came out, and the various right wing papers in the UK, from the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph,
more imprisonment, swift justice, law and order.
Right, of course. Right, if anybody familiar with
heart.
The Toronto,
yeah.
Anybody familiar with the Toronto Sun, will know the kind of response you're going to get, and the type of analysis.
Yeah.
And David Cameron said it was parenting, parenting, parenting.
Oh.
Now, David Cameron is a prime minister who's convinced that the way to solve the budget crisis in the UK, which happened within the context of a global economic crisis caused by, the super rich,
mm-hmm.
and now he wants to solve this crisis on the backs of the most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he says this rioting is about parenting, 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 the fact that he wants to solve this budget crisis on the back of the most vulnerable. I mean, what does that say about David Cameron's parents?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll leave your listeners to decide about that.
Okay. Listeners, but up to you.
And I think from the left, we of course saw there was attention to the broader context of deprivation in these neighborhoods.
Yeah. That's begun to come out.
Of policing.
Yeah.
Of racism. Tottenham as a neighborhood has the third highest child poverty rate in all of London. The recent cuts that were made by the Conservative, or its coalition government between the Conservative and the Liberal Democrats, resulted in 8 of Tottenham's 12 youth and community centres being closed down.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me.
Yeah.
That's disproportionate in Tottenham, isn't
it? Hugely disproportionate.
Wow.
And it's also a place of very high unemployment and youth unemployment. For every one job, there's 54 people chasing that job in that neighborhood.
Okay.
So I think the attention to context is important. Now, that's kind of like a national or a local context, but I think there's also a broader context that we're seeing this level of social unrest in response to how governments and the economic conditions that have been created by the global economic crisis. The IMF chief, or the chief of the International Monetary Fund, or former chief, he's gotten to his own...
Strauss-Kahn?
His own problems, which
yeah,
is probably
right.
is a topic for another show.
Yeah.
But Strauss-Kahn, 2 years ago, warned of social unrest. He said that, there would be this type of urban violence, maybe sparked by a prolonged global slump,
mm-hmm.
and also by the way governments are going to respond to that slump.
Mm-hmm.
There's the broader context, like I said at the top of the show. You had young people in France, in poor neighborhoods where they suffer social exclusion, in 2007 and again in 2009, responding to the death of poor racialized youth in police custody or being chased by police,
mm-hmm.
with rioting. And the looting wasn't as widespread, but there was rioting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as I mentioned as well, well, in Montreal North, and the death of Freddie Villanueva, which I wrote about in the Toronto Star back in 2008.
Right.
You saw that young people kind of responding in maybe one of the few ways that they know how to, especially if they're not organized.
Well, and they don't have a lot of means, right? They don't have.
No.
They don't really have media at their disposal. The only way they can command media is by being outrageous.
Right. Right, and I think that's, and I think you saw that also in Britain, in just a national kind of historical context in Britain. It was a lot of young people in the 1980s expressed frustration with the cuts that Margaret Thatcher was making.
Tell us.
This is the kind of riots, the similar type of riots in the 1980s in places like Brixton, which is South London, Tottenham again in the 1980s as well. I think 1984 there was a huge riot in Tottenham centered on a public housing complex called Broadwater Farm that led to the death of a police officer and also the death of a local resident.
Okay.
Liverpool again in the 1980s in a neighborhood called Toxteth.
Okay.
And again, you see a similarity in terms of both the economic conditions happening, the relations between the police and the youth who live there, and also in the right's response. But it's funny, as you're seeing the right respond to this now, as you've seen the Conservative government respond to this, it kind of mirrors Margaret Thatcher's response to this, to similar type of riots, in the sense that Thatcher placed such an emphasis on personal responsibility,
right.
The right-wing press that these people are just thugs, mm-hmm. they're mindless, they're mm-hmm. hooligans,
mm-hmm.
and they're really a failure to acknowledge kind of more structural conditions in which people face.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, just like Cameron now is talking about kind of investing in these neighborhoods or fixing broken families, and I put that in air quotes.
Wow.
So there is a recognition, however reticent it is, that there are social conditions which bring about that are part of the context.
And we didn't get this from Thatcher, did we?
No.
Okay.
No, well, Thatcher eventually came around. The riots, it's funny, the riots in Liverpool, you know, Thatcher was very harsh, partly because she didn't like the political, the city council in Liverpool at the time, which was controlled by a radical left faction of the Labour government.
Okay.
But Thatcher was saying, you know, it's all about personal responsibility and all these thugs in Liverpool creating havoc for the police and for, you know, respectable people.
Respectful.
And yet she assigned a minister specifically for Liverpool.
Oh,
to
really?
Try to look at some of the social context in which this took place.
Okay.
So again, there's a kind of dual response that we're seeing. It's very contradictory from right-wing governments.
So almost an implicit recognition of the social context, but an explicit denial.
I think so.
Very
I think
strange.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So what's going to come of this situation? Riots seem to be a newly popular way of expressing social discontent. Italy, Greece, France, Britain, Canada, I mean Vancouver, Toronto,
right.
G20. What's going to come of this? Is this becoming a new mode of social expression that governments have basically supported by their actions?
I think it's difficult to tell, and it's also, I mean, it's hard. You want to be careful not to clump all these instances of urban violence and urban unrest into the same category,
because
they do have different contexts.
Okay.
And I think that's important. See, that the riots that happened in Athens, which are a kind of indirect response to the Greek government's
austerity
and the European Union's austerity measures, is one thing. They were very politicized as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where the left has kind of, the left analysis of the London riots is really lacking.
Now for the show's first break, Kenny Blues Boss Wayne. Send me an angel. Lord, I'm full of misery.
Off work, stop by my favorite bar. I have one drink, start talking about the war.
shout and get mad. Start talking about the woman I never had. Heaven send me. Send me an angel to rescue me. This world drives me crazy. Lord, I'm full of misery. I get all my money on a Friday night. I'm ready for anything, even ready to start a fight. When money is gone, I get evil as can be. Start showing off to every woman I see. Heaven send me an angel to rescue me. This job drives me crazy. Lord, I'm full of misery. A drunk from another part of town. Man, you don't know, bad news is at your door. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. Heaven send me an angel to rescue me. Some folks drive me crazy. Send me an angel to rescue me. Some folks drive me crazy. Lord, I'm full of misery. Full of misery. To you. No, you over there. One that called me a drunk. I ain't drunk. I've just been drinking.
You're listening to Simon Black, York University academic, as he talks to us about his insights into what we now know as the London riots and the insights they hold for the future of Canadian cities.
You had people like Naomi Klein, who, you know, a great journalist who I respect, was talking about how, you know, the national context for this in the UK is that you have you know, you have the Cameron government intent on cutting back and bringing in austerity measures that is going to affect neighborhoods like this.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, as you have this, you know, massive bailout of British banks, record bonuses in the City of London, which is basically the UK's version of Wall Street, where all the financial traders and the
bankers, the bonuses there have hit records, have they?
Yeah, at record levels after we've seen a global economic crisis was very much the cause of the type of speculation and trading that was done in Wall Street and in the City of London. So, you know, you have the Cameron government cutting back. You have an expenses scandal, which was with UK politicians claiming two houses on at the taxpayers' expense.
Right.
So that's kind of the national context. And a lot of left-wing commentators were saying, you know, this of course, you've got to draw parallels between the fact that, you know, the looting of the public purse and the looting of the high street, which was the, you know, the main streets. And I think that's true. I think those sort of parallels should be drawn. And it's very hypocritical of David Cameron, who's intent on cutting back services and not intent on prosecuting people who were caught up in this expenses scandal.
Yeah.
It's very hypocritical because it shows that there's one law for the poor and one law for the rich.
Yeah.
But at the same time, back to these different, you know, different instances of riots and urban unrest that we've seen, there is a broader kind of social context for this. But at the same time, I think the riots in London showed not so much a presence of politics, you know, and an awareness that the politicians and the big bankers are getting away with looting the public treasury. So why don't we loot, you know,
right.
We being the youth, loot H&M and Foot Locker, whatever.
Yeah.
Not so much a presence of politics, but an absence of politics. You know, that is the inability of or unwillingness of the organized left, of labor, of various left-wing groups, of trade unions, to actually organize young people in poor communities and direct their rage towards progressive political ends.
Yeah.
And the actual power centers of British society, as opposed to their shadows
right.
in the police and in high street shops.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that's kind of been lost, is that the left should look at something that's happened like London and say, yes, we understand the rage that a lot of young people have, but why aren't we directing that rage? Why aren't we organizing in these communities and directing that rage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember
towards the actual power centers that control and create the conditions in which these people live.
Yeah, I remember I remember Sarkozy coming back with a political response to the riots in France, which was surprising a conservative recognition of shortcomings in the system and disentitlements that were unremarked up until the riots took place. It seemed to bring about the recognition that the youth wanted in France. It doesn't seem to have done that in Britain, but kind of behind the back with a wave of the hand sort of thing, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give them more money and shut them up.
Right.
Yeah.
And I would just add, there's been some really interesting research coming out. A couple of economists traced the relationship between austerity and urban unrest over a period, I think, of 100 years. They looked at data on close to 40 European Latin American countries.
Really?
And they were able to show a clear and positive statistical association between government spending cuts
right.
and levels of unrest. And
right.
this unrest included government demonstrations, which are, of course, more political, riots, strikes, and attempted revolutions.
Right.
So I think what their research is showing is that while not a cause of all instances of urban unrest, the possibility of this type of urban violence goes up
as a contributor,
yeah. Yeah.
And a big contributor too, because it's statistically correlated.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it tells the story in many places, but not the full story in all places, I think would be.
Yeah. Yeah. We experienced the G20 riots, which were still not done with. Now, the problem they had there was the number of people that they arrested and the charges that they laid, apparently without a lot of support for those charges. In Britain, we've seen the same thing with the first person charged on not even present, as you mentioned, at the riots, but on a related charge of receiving looted property, stolen property, released with a much lighter sentence than the government had promised for these this involvement.
But yeah, I read about that, and I think it's kind of interesting that you're seeing, you know, that David Cameron promised to mobilize the full force of the police and the courts, right?
And fill the prisons too.
Pushing back, and the prisons, right?
Right.
And you're seeing judges kind of pushing back against this. You know, the case that you talk about, where this young single mother in Manchester had received a pair of shorts from stolen goods from a shop that was looted on the Manchester High Street.
Right.
And I can't remember what the government was pushing for in terms of her sentence.
No.
But the judge essentially just, you know, I think she got away with a small fine or something and dismissed this as ridiculous and over the top.
Yeah.
So I think you'll see a little bit of tensions, or I think we are seeing tensions between the British judiciary, which is intent on maintaining its independence and dealing with this in an even-handed and fair way, and the government, which is trying to puff up its chest and show that these, you know, unlike the politicians and the bankers caught in the both the expenses scandal and the global economic crisis, that these people, the poor, will definitely have to suffer as a result of their actions.
Yeah. Now, the prisons are almost full, and I haven't heard an awful lot about sentencing, except this first woman to have her case resolved in her favor. It sounds to me like there's more unrest in the making, or it's certainly dismissals in the making, with the prisons full and undoubtedly the judiciary unwilling to handle it with a stereotypical response for everybody, which would make the processing fast but wouldn't make it fair. And so these people are going to get long times waiting for trial, and then they're going to get their cases dismissed from the look of it.
You know, and I hope that's the case in most instances. The Guardian newspaper has been following the court cases and kind of keeping a log of people who have been coming through, and they've done this really interesting thing on their website where they're keeping a profile of kind of a socioeconomic profile of all the people who appear on charges in front of the courts, and
that's something,
you know,
you've
apart from
see.
Comment apart from commenting about it's very interesting. Apart from commenting about the sentencing, they're making the case that yes, the vast majority of the rioters brought before the courts are young, poor, and unemployed. I mean, they're also male, which is definitely a gender dynamic to this that should be considered as well. It's more likely young men who engage in this sort of behavior.
So far, yes, but I think
It's definitely interesting to look at, you know, how this is going to play out in the British courts and the judicial system more generally.
Well, I mean, the specter is of a large part of a generation submerged in the jails when, the social context of their problem should be being addressed, when they should be, you know, efforts should be made to give them training, efforts should be made to give them jobs, efforts should be made to give them involvement in society so that the disrespect for society is not deserved, and engagement with society is purposeful and produces positive change. But instead, you know, the specter is that they'll be moldering in jail, and what will they be when they get out? They won't be any different when they get out.
Right.
And conservatives tend to forget that.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point, because if you look at you know, how people, how young people in these neighborhoods view the state, you know, if they're not getting access to state services through training, through labor market initiatives, through community centers, through employment centers, their only contact with the state becomes through the judicial system and through the police.
Well, and through the...
Then they're not going to view the state as legitimate, right?
And the so ATM, that is their checks, which they would probably rightly come to regard as a buyout.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
they're not gonna view this state doesn't have any legitimacy in their eyes.
That's true. It only appears when it wants to take something. We've seen a little bit of that in Ontario. You know, hi, I'm from the government. You know, we have a new electricity plan. We have a new tax plan, reducing taxes for big business. We have a new provincial unified tax with the federal government, and we promise it's not going to cost you anymore. You know, this specter of a government that only appears with its hand out is not even unfamiliar to Canadians, but it must be crushing when you don't have a job, and you, as you say, there are 54 people applying for every job that you apply for, and there is no training, and your dad lived the same way, and your children are probably, you know, you can already see that they're probably going to live the same way. It must be crushing.
Right. And this is, you know, this is...
And then the government steps in and says, well, we could use a little more from you. We're going to take some more away, you know.
cut backs to welfare, or cut your, you know, lock up your community center and say it can't be funded.
Yeah.
And this is, we're going on 30 years now, right, of this neoliberal program of austerity, privatization, of deregulation, where we're seeing the withdrawal of state services, the cuts to social programs.
Wow.
So it's not surprising that more people are questioning the legitimacy of this state. Yeah. And in a lot of places, that legitimacy was fragile to begin with, right? But it's increasingly being called into question. I think that's one of the conclusions or one of the observations we can definitely make when looking at the instance of the UK.
Yeah, well, we've been 16 years of it in Ontario, too, although Ontario is prosperous compared to England, and we haven't seen, except for the G20, and unless you're black, we haven't seen the same kind of police repression, but it's building. It's, you know, we've asked the police in Hamilton, for instance, to take cuts, as they have in Toronto, but we've also told them we want you out there hassling people who look poor. Hassling people who aren't attractive to look at, hassling people who are lingering in the wrong places, in other words, places where people want to spend money. People who, we want you to hassle people who don't have enough money and are out there asking for more.
I think seeing that type of policing that we're seeing that began in the Harris era and the Common Sense Revolution with the passing of that piece of legislation called the Safe Streets Act, which gave the police license to kind of do the everyday harassment of those who they, you know, of the marginalized, of those who they felt didn't belong in our city centers. So,
and that's, you know, by appearance. That's profiling.
It is profiling. I think we're seeing that level of police repression in our communities, but I don't think we're seeing the type of responses that we've seen in France and the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you know, what could lead to that?
Now we'll take a break with Joe Louis Walker, Hustlin' My Life Away.
Well, I'm hustling
You're listening to Simon Black, York University academic, as he talks to us about his insights into what we now know as the London riots and the insights they hold for the future of Canadian cities.
I spoke to, I spoke to a youth worker last week when I was doing following up on some research that I'd done in the priority neighborhoods in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen a fair share of urban unrest in Toronto in the form of gang and gun violence.
All right.
And this youth worker, I asked them to reflect on the London riots. And he works in a gang intervention and youth education program in Rexdale.
All right.
And he said the program receives money from both the city and from the federal government, and but their funding's on the chopping block this year, and they've already been forced to reduce some programming to save over the long term.
I can understand the city chopping their funding. Are the feds chopping their funding too?
Yes. Yeah. Oh. He said get both from the feds and the city. So he's in anticipation of the cuts that Ford's going to make in next year. They're already reducing some of their programming.
Oh.
So I asked this worker. I said, you know, what you saw in London, you know, could you see something similar happening in Toronto?
Yeah.
And he said to me, and I wrote down the quote, but I remembered off the top of my head. He said, you know, the fuel is there, the frustration, the feeling of being left out, the social exclusion of having no future.
Yeah.
All it needs is a spark. What he said.
Yeah.
So I think when you hear people on the ground who are working in these communities and working with young people on a day-to-day basis, when they're making comments like that, then it's really time for governments to take notice.
Yeah. I spoke with a civil servant who either lived or worked in Brampton. I can't recall now. It was some time ago. And they said to me, I know where it's going to start too. And I looked at them in surprise. I said, well, what's your feeling on that? And they said, Brampton. Because it's all racial minorities and immigrants. And they thought that Brampton was ripe for that kind of response. Bill Davis' hometown.
Bill Davis' hometown, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what's that tell you about the change?
I mean, I think we should be careful not to equate just the fact that there's racial minorities in the neighborhood with the fact that there's a chance for urban unrest. There's a context of police, both police repression, racial profiling, and poverty.
And employment problems, yeah.
Employment problems and disproportionately racialized poverty.
Yeah.
But if you look in London or in France, there's white youth in these neighborhoods as well that take part in this sort of action, who are also facing this sort of the same social conditions.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah. So what does it say that I haven't heard anything coming up to an election in October about these issues at large, about specifically addressing these issues? That doesn't mean they haven't been addressed, but I mean, I get a daily paper and they've maybe chosen not to report on this kind of thing, but I don't see an awful lot addressed towards the youth contingent of the people who are bearing this responsibilities or the price of this recession and its very weak, very slow comeback.
Yeah, it has been surprising though. At least from, I mean, I think the Toronto Star has been better than other media outlets in looking at kind of the deep poverty that's developing in our urban centers and also the social exclusion and polarization of our cities, but you're right. It doesn't seem to be on the minds of
or the radar
of political leaders so far.
No,
and one has to ask whether governments who seem to make policy, in reaction to things, as opposed to kind of being more proactive and preventative, whether it's going to take the type of urban unrest we've seen in other places around the world for the government, the Ontario government, or whether it be the city government in Hamilton or Toronto, to actually respond in a more comprehensive, sustained way to the social conditions of our particular neighborhoods.
We are facing potentially, I'm not a demographer, but we're facing potentially a demographic, an age, and an asset level split. Because I spoke to someone last night who was very upset that he had, some time ago, he had taken his Harley downtown, he'd parked it, he'd come out, and he'd found ketchup smeared on the handlebars, and he felt that this showed a disregard for property from people he estimated probably didn't have property and probably didn't have jobs. That was his guess. He didn't see it happen. He doesn't know. But we discussed it, and I said, you know, I think things are different in the small towns. And he said, yeah, that's what I've been talking about with my wife. I want to get out of this job as fast as I can and move to a small town. Now, that's an asset shift because that's the boomers and all their savings, right?
Right.
That's a demographic shift. It's 65 and up in the small towns and youth stuck in the cities. So it's an asset shift, a demographic shift. It's the future knocking on the door saying, if you want to solve these problems, solve them while the means are still in the cities, solve them while the people are still concerned, solve them before they move away and take their assets with them, and you're left with cities full of people with no assets, no jobs, no tax revenue, and you have a serious problem then.
Right. I think what you've just done there is give a perfect summation of what happened in the United States in the 60s and 70s with the urban crisis.
I never thought of that.
You had the flight of the middle class and the more secure working class from the inner cities to the suburbs, and mm-hmm. it left cities facing a huge crisis.
Yeah, economically and civilly.
Economically, and because I mean there was unrest in the 60s. A lot of people responded to that. But those who had means by moving out of the cities. So you had core cities then who were having to provide an increasing amount of services
with decreasing amount of income.
But with a decreasing amount of income as their tax base eroded.
And you end up with Detroit.
Exactly, where you have kind of a hollowing out of the city.
Mm-hmm. Who knows where they all went? I mean, but they're gone. That's clear.
Yeah, well, right. If you go to Detroit and you look at the suburbs, there's really a kind of a stark divide between if anybody knows Detroit and knows 8 Mile Road, those who live outside beyond 8 Mile and those who live within the city limits
really
know that it's a very stark racial and economic divide in that city between the suburbs and the inner city. And cities, it's very hard, it's very difficult for cities. They're trying now to actually recover, recover from that urban crisis.
So the famously successful Canadian cities are beginning to look a little more fragile in light of these phenomena.
I think that's what's happening. I think we're starting to mirror more of this cities we see in other kind of advanced industrialized countries.
So it's not to do with politics. It doesn't matter who's ruling these cities, who's elected, they're going to face the same problems to claw back.
And the governments do face them.
And deal with reduced income. I mean, an NDP-flavored city would have to deal with it the same as a conservative-flavored city, but the results wouldn't be... I don't think the results would be a lot different. So this is bigger than us. It's
bigger than just the city governments, and it really points the need for a national urban strategy.
Yeah,
Which, cities have been asking this for years. We're talking just days after the death of one of the greatest political champions of cities, Jack Layton.
Yes,
longtime city councillor and leader of the NDP, who, when he was president of the Federation of the Canadian Municipalities, was saying, push for that New Deal for cities, and was saying that the cities, we need a national urban strategy to address city-specific needs and address the fact that they don't have a lot of levers to raise revenue apart mm-hmm. from the property tax base, which is not sustainable. And this is happening at a time where governments, Ontario's slightly different because we're seeing Dalton McGuinty start to upload some of the services that Mike Harris downloaded mm-hmm. on cities. Mm-hmm. But funnily enough, back to talking about the political, the campaign coming up, or kind of underway now for the provincial elections, Tim Kudak seems intent on keeping what has been downloaded.
Mm-hmm.
And putting a halt to any of the uploading going on.
Oh my gosh!
Which, you know, will just further put cities in a very poor position fiscally.
Yeah. Yeah. And are cities allowed to carry deficits?
No.
Okay.
Not under the.
So that's quite.
Not under the provincial rules.
That's quite a squeeze.
Yes.
All right. Well, Simon, it's not a pretty picture that you've painted, but I appreciate your looking at it from many sides, as you always do, and giving us a broad context as well as a deep historical context for these riots that have only, well, we'll probably hear the echoes of them for another year or two, like the G20, yeah, which seems to go on and on and on.
Right.
Thanks
for having me, Jeff.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your time, too. Appreciate that very much.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, Simon.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Simon Black, York University academic, as he talks to us about his insights into what we now know as the London riots and the insights they hold for the future of Canadian cities. And celebrating a little of what we all hope for ourselves, Chucky Weiss, Two-Tone Car, which he calls an out-of-body experience.
It got brakes on, the brakes was getting mighty cheap. Big ol' ass train, deck old ass heat. Well, in a planetary gearbox in a just on the dashboard, got a goofy bar. Everybody talking about my two-tone car. Two-tone car, that's what it is. Going out speaking like a planetary gear. Two-tone car, going very far. Everybody talking about my two-tone car. Everybody's talking about my two-tone car. Talking about my two-tone car. Everybody's talking about my two-tone car.
talking about my tone car. Everybody's talking about my tone car. Everybody's talking about my tone car.
This week we begin a new feature by reminding you that if your mom knew Dalton McGuinty had cut what you can eat by cutting the special diet requirements, she'd be up one side of him and down the other, wouldn't she? But we have something for you to do when your dinner finishes too soon because your special diet has been reduced. We call it Things to Do When the Special Diet Short Circuits Your Dinner. Tonight, we introduce bun puppets. Now, you get buns with dinner, and you probably leave them till the last. In this case, we want you to take a knife and crease that bun, maybe poke two holes in it above the crease. If you want, you can put raisins in the holes, or you can put red kidney beans for a mean look if you slant them up, and you can put in white kidney beans for the Orphan Annie look. But once you've done this, your bun puppet will have a mouth, and it will have eyes. You put your thumb and forefinger around the bun, saving your third or your fourth finger to put inside the mouth because there's no spring in a dinner roll. And you can make it say whatever you want, like, I'm Dalton McGuinty, and I'm just doing what's best for Ontarians, or I'm Tim Hudak, and I'm going to cut the bejesus out of the budget, whatever. But you have your very own bun puppet. And if you save two buns, you have a bun puppet conversation. It's good to extend your dinner time quite a while, despite the cuts from the special diet. Come back to Disrespect next week for more dinner time special diet fun. Before we leave the show, I got this by word of mouth and I haven't had a chance to verify it. September the 14th. Hamilton Spectator Auditorium, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., a pre-election dialogue, otherwise known as an all-candidates meeting. You're welcome. It's free. And why wouldn't you go? September the 14th, Hamilton Spectator Auditorium, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., a pre-election dialogue. See you there. Oh, and don't let me forget to mention the disrespect petition against tracking your whereabouts on the new Presto card in Hamilton and in Toronto. It's at gopetition.com or Canadian Petition Online. Sign up and show your protest as we approach the provincial election October 6th. Tell Dalton McGuinty or whoever wins the election you don't want them keeping track of your whereabouts through a transit card. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.
Hello, my name is Richard.
Hello, my name is Poppy.
My dad used to work here, and my uncle still works here too. This is 93.3 WCFMU. Bye-bye.